Hello! Today I'm joined by musician, radio producer, and podcast host, Giles Bitter. Giles hosts the fantastic podcast, 101 Part-Time Jobs, where he dives in with established and independent musicians to talk about how they have sustained themselves and their music. I did an episode with Giles and talked about many of my old jobs, some of the weird ones, some of the wild ones. I was a garbage man, I've been a dishwasher, I was a roof salesman during the housing crisis, I've had a lot of different jobs. Giles is one of the best hangs that there is. We've spent many a times together over in the UK as well as the United States. We played with his old band, Great Cynics, on many occasions. He's a deeply loving and insightful character, one of my favorite people to see in the world. I mentioned it during the show, but in the spring of 2019, we went on a once-in-a-lifetime odyssey through London, hitting about 15 pubs on the last day of a binge before taking a long break from drinking in a pack that I did with Roger Harvey. And now, currently taking another long break, so I feel it's really fitting that we have this chat. Now, I do have to have Giles back, as I have a bunch of questions in front of me that we didn't get to. He said he would come back, so I'm really stoked. I got a couple secret, sneaky ones from some friends over in England that I can't wait to sandbag him with. And I feel like as a podcast host and a person with journalism training and being in the world for so many years, I think he'd appreciate it. But yeah, here we go. Giles Bitter. And we're rolling. Giles, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Cheers. Like, hell, you're, yeah, in one of my favorite bands in the world. This is cool.
Thank you so goddamn much. I wanted to talk to you today about your journey itself. I wanted to flip the 101 back on you a little bit.
And journey to the end.
Ask you, yeah, journey to the end. We'll just roll that bass line up. You know, we'll do that bass line equivalent of a podcast today.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, man. So what was it like for you in high school and middle school?
Didn't have many friends in school, but had friends outside school that went to local gigs. I, like everyone, this year and last year, reminisced a lot, thought about, you know, and one of the things I thought a lot about, I was like, why am I so obsessed with music? You know, especially doing 101 part-time jobs.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know why I'm so stoked on it, but I am. And I have been, you know, ever since. I grew up in a really rural village. I've got a cool ghost story for you later, actually. Really rural village where on a Friday night, you know, a local band, you know, it was around the Blink-182 era, Green Day era, you know, the probably 99, 2000, 2001. And there was a local band playing, and, you know, pop punk band. And I don't know why, but I just was enamored by the fact there was a local band. Like, I don't care what you sounded like, if you were rap, metal, or indie rock, it wouldn't matter to me at that time. A local band was a local band, and I found that the most exciting thing in the world. And I went to boarding school for a few years before that. So I'm one of three, and I'm the youngest. And my brother or sister didn't go to boarding school, but I got sent to boarding school because my dad was like fairly violent towards me. And so I went to boarding school, and then so I had that whole kind of thing going on where I was like, it was like an orphanage, you know. I've told a lot of friends growing up as a teenager, you know, I went to boarding school, and after a few years, I realized that gave off the impression that it's some kind of, you know, teaser, you know, kind
like
of
posh, like a you're
silver
rich,
spoon thing.
Okay. Yeah.
It was not that. It was not that at all. It was more of an orphanage.
Now, was going to boarding school a common, do you know a lot of people who did go to boarding school? Because just coming from our American perspective of boarding school, it was something that was either extremely wealthy people did on TV, or you gotten threatened for it for misbehaving. It wasn't kind of like ingrained into our society, really.
Yeah, I don't know. I've met a few people, but I'm not close with anyone who went to boarding school.
Sure, sure.
So I really don't know. My parents grew up in Harrow, which is a sort of suburb of northwest London.
Okay.
And, you know, they grew up in the, or, you know, got their first jobs, I suppose, in the 70s and 80s, and then were, you know, experienced that 80s, 90s boom, I guess. I'm not very good on economics, but I'm pretty sure there was a boom there because that was where everyone's parents bought houses.
Yeah, I think we're being punished for that now.
You're telling me, throwing money down a hole to our landlords forever. Never going to get a pension, are we?
Yeah.
But so they moved out to the countryside, and I think they probably bought into that idea that, you know, my dad being fairly aggressive towards me, probably because of, you know, being an excitable kid, like I said, you know, I was pretty bad at just sitting down. You know, I was always kind of jumping up or running around or something, and I think he couldn't handle that. And so my mum thought it was best if I go to boarding school. And I do wonder if there was a part of, you know, the idea around that was that, you know, let's get him off to boarding school because it's a good place where you can learn and do sports. And I think there was an element of a good spirit about it, but the real foundation of sending me there wasn't, you know, very nice. So I wonder if I had that thing where, you know, I felt like a castaway early on. So anything that to do where you, anything that you could share an experience with someone or you could do something as a gang, I was really attracted to. I really loved playing sports. I loved cricket. I loved football. And that was definitely to do with the fact that you're playing as a team. And I think I must have seen that in bands. I think I must have been like, this is amazing. This is cool. You know, everyone here has loads of friends.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I think that sometimes the almost gangish aspect of bands at that developmental age is somewhat overlooked or forgotten in our world when we talk about it. It really is like a pick and choose which kind of person you want to be or which table you want to sit at lunch. For us in middle school was, I can be with the musicians and the band people. That's how I want to define myself. It's who I want to be. You know, there's one, the punk rock ruined my life stickers that Mark from the Code made is kind of, I think embodies a lot of that. It's like, well, I chose this, ideologically tied social group to be a part of at that point to define myself because I would be accepted, and you just had to follow those rules, dress it. You know, it's kind of like anything else. And totally. There's something I used to think that was so corrupt, but then I realized that this what humans have been doing forever, and that's like kind of what you need to do as part of your development. And I think it's, you know, more of a great thing to end up that way. But also on the flip side, punk rock ruined my life. You know,
I found it intelligent and beautiful as well because there were lots of emo bands around that time, and you know, you'd read books like Perks of Being a Wallflower, and you know, that kind of whole thing, that was the stuff that I was wrapped up in, you know. And you know, that period of time when I saw that band in the village, you know, probably 3 or 4 years after that, I found this crew of people that would go to local gigs, and you know, probably 50% male, 50% female, and that was a massive thing as well, because going to boarding school was boys only, and
just men, just boys there.
Just boys. Wow. Yeah. Didn't really know how to talk to girls.
Yeah. And so how would you learn?
And so that was a massive
teacher
eye opener as well, because it was like, oh cool, this is all something that we're interested in. You know, if there's not a gig going on, then we'll go to the skate park and sit on the grass and listen from someone's MP3 player out of speakers. And the place where we grew up in was Watford and Amersham, those sorts of towns, those kinds of areas was, you know, I lived in Berkhamsted, so quite sort of 20 minutes away from Watford, and that's where Gallows are from.
And, okay, cool.
You know, some other hardcore bands like Your Demise and Enter Shikari. My first ever gig was opening for Enter Shikari, which was an amazing experience because I loved that band at the time. And I just turned up with my bass guitar. I played bass in this post-hardcore band called Photographs and Theories, and turned up, you know, with an Acrobat's
that
t-shirt.
Is a great first band name, you know. It's definitely like what would be in the novel or in the,
and turned know, up with just a bass guitar, and went up for sound check. I was like, oh, I don't have a lead or an amp, you know, let
just
alone
plug into the PA.
So go. The I think Chris is his name, I've never actually met him, from Enter Shikari. He was like, here's my stuff, use whatever you want. And that to me was the coolest thing in the world.
Hell yeah.
And that was really definitive.
So it sounds like the kind of DIY shows and first shows were very similar to the ones that we had. So you'd show up to a place that was not maybe necessarily a traditional venue. A lot of ours were like VFWs, which is an organization, Veterans of Foreign Wars. So it's like one part is a bar full of veterans from foreign wars, and then the other part would be a hall that they would use for community events, and they would let us rent them out to have shows in. So a lot of them were that, and high school talent shows and shit like that. And I always kind of wondered what it would be like for you guys.
I think a similar situation, we had a scout hut. A scout hut sounds pretty similar to that. So on Saturdays and Sundays, I suppose it would be used by scout clubs.
Like Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of, yeah, cool.
Yeah, yeah. Other times, I don't know, where were the other gigs? Like town halls? I don't know. Yeah. I wonder, I look back and I'm like, who put on those gigs? I mean, right. One of them, so the big promoter that would put on the regular shows at the Scout Hut was a guy called Jamie Osman, and now he manages the Cribs, and he's like a big, you know, he's been working in the music industry for a long time now. I think he, you know, started working in the music industry full time when he was like 17 or 18 or something. So we were surrounded by all these people doing stuff. And I think it was around that time I got more into just punk rock, I suppose. And so as soon as I recognized that there was a punk rock faction in my town, you know, I'd just start saying hi to them in town and becoming friends with them.
Amazing.
And they were in a band that I was just obsessed with. You know, I used to go to outs. They wouldn't even know it because I wasn't even good enough friends with them yet, but I knew kind of when they were practicing, and I'd go to one of their houses where they were practicing and sit on the curb outside and listen. You know, I was just obsessed. I don't know why. It's fucking weird.
I mean, it makes total sense. I love that so much.
So just big into it, and just big into the local thing, making it happen.
Hell yeah. So you've always been attached to it, and I've been impassioned by it. Did you end up going to university after high school?
Was like, yeah, cool. But late. So not after high school. When high school finished, funny story actually, so the UCAS form is the form that you fill out to go to university after your A-levels or college or whatever that year is when you're 17, 18. And I suppose at my school there was a quota, because when I said I didn't want to do my UCAS form because I didn't know what I was going to study, and also I was in a band by this point where I was, you know, used my obsession for emailing and using MySpace messages. So all I wanted to do was go on tour. So I just did not revise for my exams at all. I was more interested in what I would consider now being like a tour manager, or like, you know, the stuff that no one wants to do now.
Sure,
if you're playing in the band.
Absolutely.
So I wasn't going to get the grades. And I said, oh, look, I'm not going to do my UCAS form. And she took me outside into the corridor, yelled at me, and she was like, I'm gonna do everything I can to get you kicked out of this school.
Wow.
And I remember thinking that's so strange. Now I can kind of put it down, maybe there was a quota about how many pupils they wanted in the school to go to university.
That's so funny, and such a thing that happens. You know, one of my favorite parts of getting with age is really realizing how complex people's motivations were when they either wronged you or you had to interface with them in your past. You're like, well, maybe she didn't hate me, she was just like, maybe her life was a fucking pain in the ass, and this bratty kid wouldn't fill out his fucking UCAS form.
And so she took it to the next level. She called me into the headmaster's office with my mum because I just kept on saying no. And then I was made to write an apology. And, you know, I'm not very good at being passive aggressive, I suppose, but I wrote the most passive aggressive apology note as demanded, required. Yeah, exactly. And my mum's actually still got a photocopy of that letter on her desk at home.
That's
where
so
she writes,
funny.
Which is kind of funny. Props to my mum for supporting me there.
Yeah, but hell yeah.
After that, I went to Brighton because there was a journalism course. I didn't know what to do. I was writing for NME, the website.
Yeah.
At that time, you know, very not NME, cool. The website, but the website for NME. And I got that job because I wanted to go to Grosrock to see the Get Up Kids. And I'd interned there just months before that, and I rang up the guy who I knew at NME liked punk. I was like, look, I'm going to go see the Get Up Kids. It's at Grosrock. I think, you know, there's killer lineup, as always, at Grosrock in that year. It's 2009. Can I review it? And so I started writing for the website then. And so I was like,
so there's actually, if you don't, I wanted to zone in on that real quick. You have always peripherally, at least, been attached to the coverage of music, for lack of a better word for it. You are have always written. You are now an audio journalist. You have been a musician and are a musician, fantastic musician at that. We played many shows together. But this early on, when you were 17, you got this job at NME. Were you writing before that? Like, did you just kind of like right place at right time it? Like, how did you end up carving out that part of the world for yourself?
I didn't even consider the facts that I was being a writer, if that makes sense. I just wanted
Before you mentioned that you were interested in being like a tour manager or any of these peripheral kind of roles or something I didn't want. So I was wondering if you just stumbled into the writing and it just happened to work, or if there was something that was there for you.
I think with that Grosrock thing, I was like pulling the festival scam again. How could I get into this festival?
For anybody who doesn't know, we had talked about scams before we started recording this. And yeah, I think that that's great that you used it as a it was your ticket to the festival.
Totally.
Amazing.
I remember digging out my older brother, you know, was my idol growing up. He had this massive, you know, huge Reading Festival 2002 poster. And I got into half the bands that I love now from reading that poster and being like, oh, I'm going to listen to them. And I'm one of his friends at school wrote this punk zine and, you know, this thing like fucking, you know, 4 centimeters thick. It must have had like 60 pages in and the font size is like 8 or something. And it's all these amazing stories and it's written in a way that I didn't really understand. You know, I didn't really understand the jokes. I didn't understand the kind of esoteric nature of these bands or what they were. But I was, sure. I don't know why, but they're definitely cracked open some curiosity in me. And so when my brother went to, I must have been 8 or 9 years old, and my brother went to Reading Festival, and I was so jealous that you know, maybe my mum gave me the idea actually, but I think she might have been like, well, why don't you just write about it as if you were there. So I wrote like a fake Reading Festival review zine aged wow. 9 or 10. But other than that, that's no.
So at the age of 9 or 10 you wrote a fake zine about going to Reading.
4 sides, baby. Yeah.
That's so fucking cool. I love it. Do you still have it?
Oh, no. No. I wish I did. I'm pretty sure I covered Limp Bizkit. I was big into Limp Bizkit. I wrote fan mail to every single member because that was the time where in a CD booklet they would have a mailing address. Well, I suppose you still do now, don't you?
Sure. But, sometimes, yeah.
I wrote individual letters for each 7 or 8 members of Limp Bizkit at the time saying wow. what I liked about chocolate starfish.
That's
and hot dog flavored water. yeah, it's just pretty obsessed with it. I don't know why. Yeah. But the writing thing didn't really consider me, you know, I'm not sure if I consider myself a journalist now to be, I don't think I'm a good writer. But
I think you're a good writer. I remember actually the moment they told me you were a journalist. It was it's very blurry, as you can imagine. This is in like 2010 or 2011 or 2012. We had just played a festival. You were riding with us. We were on our way
Reading
back
festival.
To. Was it Reading Festival? That's what it was. Yeah. We were on our way back to stay at someone's house. So we were in someone's apartment, and everyone who lived there wasn't there, but they had let us in to stay there. That's all I really remember. I remember sleeping in like a very, in a girl's room that was, I'd say a girl's room, it was very pink and there was like feathery shit everywhere. And I was like, this is interesting. I'll never meet this person. I was going to crash here tonight. But I remember that night while we were all drinking, you'd mentioned in passing that you were working as a writer. And I was like, oh shit, Giles is a journalist? That's fucking cool. And then I remember planting that in my mind and kind of framing it that way from then on.
So, I do enjoy writing. I do get satisfaction from it. My mum's a writer. She writes crime fiction.
Oh, shit. That's cool.
She's amazing. And she made us learn how to spell at a young age. And she made us, you know, learn how to use commas in the right place and when to use a comma and when to use a full stop, which is something she still calls me up on. But
while you're texting her.
Totally. I know in every job application, I send it to her and she, you know, it's cool. It's cool like that. I did that journalism qualification. It wasn't a degree, it was a qualification in Brighton, but for me it was a means to an end. It was a means to do something because I didn't have the grades to get to uni. I got all D's. I got a DDE in my final year, but the year before that I got a U in something. So if you arrange those letters, you know what I mean,
dude.
Yeah. I don't want to ever let myself forget that.
That's pretty great.
But I just wasn't that good at, you know, I just wasn't that interested. I wasn't that, you know, developed in thinking that that stuff was actually important. Sure. But after that, I interned. So yeah, I've always felt like this. I've always felt like, oh, I'll go towards journalism because that's the only thing that I really can see myself doing, even though I can't actually see myself doing. And the other thing is that similar to playing music, it's something a lot of people want to do. And everyone's doing it for free.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I laugh about now, and especially going into podcasting.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, these are the 3 things in my life that I'm kind of, I guess, orbit me or I orbit it or whatever. But none of them make money. I don't know. You know, I've never been good with money. I'm good with having it. I'm bad with spending it. So that's that's kind of been on my mind. And you know, going to uni as well. So after the Brighton thing, I started playing alone as Cynics. And then after 2 years, recorded an album. And then my favorite label in the world ever, Household Name Records, were up for putting it out. So they put it out. And then so I thought, well, what do I do now? Naturally, what's the step now? You know, before I was like, okay, well, I'll spend half my time doing music, half my time interning at all these magazines, which I love doing. Like Huck magazine is a great magazine where I interned. But I was never making any money. You know, I was just sort of figuring it out, living it.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's doing hard to monetize that in and of itself. You know, it's like, especially in a time now where people are not into, seems like there's a pendulum swinging back, but people are not into paying for anything, which, yeah. You know, yeah. Makes sense. You could look at anything you want for free. There's a million blogs. People get information, Twitter, you know, like whatever. It's not a demand for someone to be paid a high amount of money for it. So you figure out how to monetize it. But I do think it's important to realize that while you're playing music, the job you're doing is being around people who work in music and musicians and talking to them and kind of not necessarily creating a network where you're going to trade favors, but just finding those people, being in the mindset and increasing your chances of having luck. You know, like they say, you can't make your own luck, but you can kind of like, you can push yourself towards the door.
Totally.
That's really cool. You just dove in.
I think that's a really interesting aspect of it because you know, sometimes when you're at a party and then you're speaking to someone who's in, you know, doing a creative endeavor and they're obviously looking over your shoulder at the person behind you who's way, who has way more credential than I do, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I feel that so much and I'm like, oh, I hope I never do that. I think I've probably been criticized in the past for trying to look in the direction of, you know, being friends with people where you're trying to grow together, I suppose.
Sure.
And I think that's a really interesting thing in punk rock, especially because naturally we never want to look like we're trying too hard.
Yeah, which to me has just been such a funny paradigm in so many parts. Like there's so many parts of myself who didn't want to do something because I thought it was as like, you know, like self-promotion wise, you didn't want to seem too egotistical or narcissistic or something. But then you realize that, well, what do I want? Like, what is my goal? It is to do it. So trying to do something, but at the same time feeling bad about doing it or not wanting to do it just seems like an absurdity. And totally. there's boundaries, you know, and you don't have to go put out a fucking song for Clorox. But like, you know, there's a lot of times, feels like in at least coming up in punk rock, and I'm in a place of extreme luck and privilege to be able to, you know, say it like this now. But there's a lot of people like crabs in a bucket, where when one crab tries to climb out of the bucket, the rest of the crabs pull them in. So there's a whole lot of like kind of shit that isn't necessarily just a hater shit, but it's like, I don't know, so many weird things where people will hate on something to then look around to see if everyone else hates it to reaffirm the fact that they didn't like it and be like, okay, that's okay.
Yeah, and you are so informed by people around you. If you know one person who's like, oh no, that's lame, that kind of plants this seed of doubt in everyone's mind. I mean, something I've learned in the last few years since not touring so much is that there is such a range of how you can be. It's not like, oh, that person's a sucker because he chatted up that person because he wanted to play the gig they were putting on. It's like there's such a large range, and ultimately, like, I think I'm wasting my time by even thinking about that stuff, because all you can really do is be yourself and be nice. You know, you're gonna get back what you put out eventually, and all you can really do is do the thing that you're doing to your best ability and like try and be cool, try and be fun to, you know, try and be nice to everyone around you, try and make people feel as good as possible. And even if that person's not making you feel that good, then, you know, fuck them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
and I think it's tough for a lot of people if they're not surrounded by people that can reinforce that idea. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think you've got to be around people that make you realize that. It doesn't really matter, man. Chill out. It's funny what you said about how people have their goals. My goal was to play Reading Festival. And that happened when we released our second album in 2013. And when that happened, I didn't know what else to do other than keep on releasing albums.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably, you know, there wasn't a sound we wanted to do. The dynamic of the the three of us wasn't right. It probably wasn't what a real band should be. You know, I think Wayne Kramer from MC5 said, when you start a band, everyone should know their roles. Everyone should know what they're doing. Yeah, I was pretty bad at doing that. We were kind of a party band, and that was great. That was awesome.
Sure. Yeah.
I probably should have like been more mature in my own sense and be like, actually, this isn't, you know, this is great right now, but know when to call it. Yeah. But then again, you know, you can't regret anything. You know, that was way before we went to Australia, for example.
Of course. Yeah. That has you here where you are now, you know, that got you here.
For real. Yeah. And, you know, at the time I didn't realize, you know, I was kind of a bit like that kind of like sad, lame Jack, you know, Kerouac kind of like person where he's just drinking for no reason. Do you know what I mean? Like nothing had a reason.
I know all about that. I had a boss that didn't drink, and I was a dishwasher when I first moved to Philadelphia at this Polish restaurant that had a series for about a decade, just people who had transplanted to Philadelphia from Scranton, which is about 2.5-3 hours north of Philadelphia, but it was another, you know, it's the big metropolitan area that you can move to that was cheaper than New York. And just had deep ties to it, yada, yada, yada. But this job, there was like a series of dishwashers and servers and cooks that were 10 years long, basically generations of people from Scranton, because somebody would be like, all right, well, I moved here. I got on my feet. I have the job that I want. So, you know, you want to move here. You could be a dishwasher, come work. And that boss of that place was always like, you guys will drink because the sun came up. It was like the whole thing. Every time we'd be like, well, yeah, we're going to get wasted tonight because, you know, Nicole got a promotion. He's like, you guys will fucking drink because the sun came up.
You will always find a reason. Always find a reason. Yeah. Anything to celebrate.
Right.
And
I wonder, you mentioned that your goal, very tangible goal, was to play Reading Festival and that you played it and you ended up in, what was that like? What does that feel like? Because I know that there's, sometimes a deep sadness comes after an accomplishment. So you can feel really, really good about reaching a goal, especially in music, but sometimes you'll hit something and it's not necessarily that it is not what you expected it to be, but it may be because your purpose has shifted or your measures have changed.
I was so concerned that all my family got on the guest list. I was so concerned that, you know, they were there and, where they wanted to be and they could find their way around the festival. My mum and my sister wore my mum wore a t-shirt that, like a Sharpie on white t-shirt saying my son's a great cynic.
Nice.
Like, that's so funny. Like that's so silly, so lame, but it's great, you know. Fuck it, it's awesome. That's all I was really concerned about, my family, I suppose. I was like, this is weird. It was so like playing a show in your hometown, you know, where everyone is there from all different kind of sections of your life that it actually makes you feel rather uneasy.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. It's like that dream.
Yeah.
Where you're naked.
Been there, man. That was real life. But no, it was great. But we played Leeds the next day. So we hopped straight in the van. I mean, there was that element of what's next, because I'm pretty goal orientated, I think. Mm-hmm. It's probably something that you get instilled from you by doing something like skateboarding. If you can see yourself doing it, you're far more likely to do it.
It's a really good point. That's an amazing point about skateboarding. That's something that ties in several big ideas. One being, you know, the physical nature of it, and then also practice. Like you have to. You know, no one is good at something just without doing it. You know, there's some people are just like that. That just have incredible luck all the time, or that can do things like, or just can throw a dart and hit the bullseye, you know, while you're drinking at the bar. They just are good at it without practicing.
Are you one of the guys that's good at bars game?
Oh, you got a friend?
our friend Dave Walensky, who is in that band Calvin Ball.
Sure, I know Dave, yeah.
I saw him look at me. So he's looking at me like, you know, we're looking at each other. Uh-huh. So he threw a dart horizontally at the board, probably, you know, regulation standard length as well. Looking at me and got bullseye.
Amazing. Yeah, there's those people who float through life like that, and I love that.
Well, I think that's how my friends see me. I think people I know probably think that I float through life.
But there's so many hidden purpose and reasons and practices that you've engulfed on. You know, like you worked.
Yeah,
you wrote a zine when you were 10. Like, That sets like it up, man. You're early when your mind was first forming its complex thoughts and understanding of the universe. You dove right into, I'm going to fucking festivals and I'm going to be in a band and I'm going to work with bands.
I mean, the household name thing, looking back on it, you know, the household name thing and the Reading thing was like, oh my God, what do I do? You know, what's now? The thing is, the trouble with something like that is that when you're so about the team, which I was, and is like, you don't know really what to do, you know, creative by committee can be hard sometimes.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. As someone in a fully democratic band, I can tell you that creating by committee can all very much, you can accomplish more in the long run for sure, but in the short term, it can be very difficult.
And that takes a lot of maturity that I didn't have then, might not have now.
Fair enough.
But one thing that I'm stoked about is that after the band fizzled out and that starting this podcast is that I can actually starting 101 part-time jobs podcast is that that is my continuation of Great Cynics.
Hell yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful thing. I really think that's awesome. I know Great Cynics is your vehicle for being in a band, creating music. It started out as Cynics and you grew it out. And now you're taking the expression and art and interaction and moving it into this podcast, which I think is great. I love listening to it. It's awesome. What do you like about it? Like, is it that you get to see all these different experiences that people have and share them? Is it like another, like, what's the creative shift about it?
Yeah, I think that hearing stories, I always think about this in, you know, I used to sleep on my brother's floor because I wanted him to tell me stories of the party he went to the weekend before. I just wanted to know about it. And, you know, those kinds of stories where, you know, we were watching Donnie Darko the other day, and, you know, when they're waiting at the bus stop and they're just telling each other these shitty stories.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they're kind of, that's that kind of older brother mentality of telling stories is something that I always just, I'm pretty drawn towards. And so, yeah, I wanted to do that. And I realized playing in Cynics, like, I'm not a musician, you know, and I know that you're probably about to say like, oh no, but you know, I'm not very good at playing guitar. Like, that band had wheels, I think, because of like our enthusiasm towards it probably. And so in that sense, I could convert that into something, you know, into a podcast, I suppose, just that kind of attitude more than anything.
Yeah.
And that's no one thing. You know, it's not one thing. It's not like a particular personality. And I don't think that I'm any kind of, I don't think that I feel like I get worried sometimes it sounds too serious. Actually, I want it to be more, you know, I love having a laugh, and I love in tragedy, which I think happens in bands a lot, there is so much humor in it.
Sure.
And there's so much funny, you know, man, like I can think of 10 times where we've been in a van, broken down, and looking at each other, being like, we've got no money, we can't do anything, you know, like, what are our prospects in life right now? This is funny.
Oh, yeah. It's hilarious, especially if there was, like, it was a ironic Murphy's Law situation where maybe you're on the way to an incredibly important show, and you're just like, well, of course it breaks down. I also think an enormous amount of humor in that surrender. Like, if you're broke down, I can think of one specifically for us. We were broke down on the side of the road in Wyoming. And in Wyoming, in the States, in the middle of nowhere, they have these giant pieces of wood that are maybe 10 feet high that are, you see in the summer, you're like, what the fuck is this? And you realize that it's to stop snow drifts. So there's giant sections of the highway where you can have a freak snowstorm. There'll be 8 feet of snow, and they just close the highway. And you're like, all right, well, we'll figure out another way to get there. And then you realize that there's no other way to get there because you're 1,000 miles away from where you need to go, and there's no other highway. So you just have to pull over. And one of the funniest times is we tried to do that. We pulled over. We're in the most podunk place I've ever been. Some guy's installing chains for us. Speaks a dialect of American English where we can barely understand anything that he says. And you're just, it's hilarious. You're just like, all right, well, here I am fucking in this joke. And it's always the most fun.
Completely no control.
Yeah, you're at the whims of the gods. You kind of just have to go with whatever they say.
That's what I love, and also it's funny because, you know, I say this from a human point of view, but it's also something that is in the whole journalism thing as well. Is that get a story in, make it a story, like exactly what you just said there, Tom. I want that on my podcast.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's exactly Absolutely. The kind of thing I'm looking for. Totally. And I feel like I've got gradually a little bit better of it at it well, over
got
like
a lot of eight, practice. I mean,
85 episodes. Yes,
exactly.
It's quite a lot. But it's all about stories, you know, and whether it's sad or funny or cool or not cool.
Even the songs that we write, the ones that people that resonate most deeply with people are the ones that have a storied factor to them or are a story or there's a change in the story. You know, that's how we've been informing each other since the beginning of grunting at the story of the fucking, I don't know, mastodon that we saw and we want to go kill it or whatever. I've actually written a book now called The Science of Storytelling by this guy, Will Storr. And there's some really cool parts about storytelling in it. One of them is that that people, once every 10 seconds, someone uses a metaphor in regular speech. So you realize that you're kind of just all using poetry and language, not as like this rigid vehicle that has rules on it, but it's like, you know, a constantly morphing way of expressing ourselves. We're constantly telling stories to relate back and forth. And one of the other things I found was fucking crazy was that you said you've been getting into filming recently. We've learned, Joe and I have been studying a bit of videography, stuff like that, and getting into frame rates. And you realize that 30 frames per second is kind of like what your eye perceives, like the way that you perceive motion. And that 24 frames per second is more cinematic and nostalgic to us, possibly because that's what it looked like for tens of thousands of years when you told a story around a fire. So the light was changing like that, and that's how we received it. So it might be like deeply Wow. ingrained in us. And I feel like songs and podcasts and movies and that kind of can make the way that we inform the world around us through storytelling hit harder with shit like that. I think it's pretty fucking cool.
That is interesting. It's very Joe Strummer.
Yeah, you know, it is really campfire. Joe Strummer. Fucking hell, yeah, you're right.
I often think, you know, in a day, I can be bummed out. I can be really bummed out for whatever reason. And then if someone tells me an interesting story that changes my day, I don't know what it is, isn't it? It is pretty interesting. But it must hit some church bell in your brain, you know, like being like, dong,
it's a great
life's actually kind of cool sometimes.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And, you know, I kind of mentioned it earlier, but you got to surround yourself with people like that. You got to surround yourself with people who see the benefit of a good story.
Oh, yeah. Not the emotional vampires. Or maybe they're only temporarily emotional vampire. I know I've been a fucking drag at points in my life.
Like one of my favorite things, well, I think it's like one of the funniest things is if you're like filming an animal and then you're doing their voiceover and you send it to someone. I think that's funny shit. Because that's a story. You're telling that animal story.
Exactly. I would love it if you would send me one. I'll send you one.
I used to be quite bad at drunk texting, so maybe I'll start getting back into it.
Yeah, if you set rules to it, that'd be great. So speaking of stories and hearing people's things and our minds changing, what I always loved the polite nature of my experience personally as an outsider, just visiting very temporarily to the UK. Sure, it's different regionally. It's going to be very similar in London as it is to New York or Paris and things like that. Mm. But the stop and chat. So in the South, in the United States, I'll never forget, the first time I was there, we were staying at a friend's house in Asheville, North Carolina. I was walking to a laundromat, and this guy was walking past me on the sidewalk. And this is a very rural, like not rural, but like, I don't know, development, like a suburb. There's not any, it was just a sidewalk by houses. There's no stores and shit. He wasn't doing business, we'll say. So I walked by this guy, and I said, "Yeah, how you doing?" And he stopped and then chatted me up for like 10 minutes. And then kept walking. I'd never experienced that before. And I noticed that in the UK, people are really polite. They'll mind your own business if you want to, or you can really kind of have a chat with somebody. And the pandemic has fucking ruined that. It's
totally
been a year of not talking to people.
Totally. That's you know, something that comes up on 101 part-time jobs a lot is because, do I need to say that title full length every time? Maybe I'll start saying 101.
There you go. 101 sounds pretty cool.
But I do like to say 101 though. I like the phonetic of 101. Anyway,
it is kind of nice, like cellar door, you know.
Totally, I like it, cellar door. Jolly hockey sticks. I think it is quite regional about the stop and chat. I have noticed North London people don't like the stop and chat. Yeah. Southeast London, out my window here, people like the stop and chat.
Yeah.
Manchester, I think it's pretty good for the stop and chat.
Sure. Yeah,
but then, pretty self-conscious as a southerner going up north.
Yeah, because of the way you speak.
Especially, you know, with my boarding school phonetics, Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
The boarding school was in Buckinghamshire, but, you know, people from Buckinghamshire generally speak a bit like this, but you do get a lot of people doing the fake London thing, which occasionally I slip into by accident. But no, you know, going up north, so you know, I know, I'm so painfully aware that I'm a southerner.
Sure.
But you're right, in the last year it has been difficult to do the stop and chat. We've got a great local pub here called the Bird's Nest, and they have local gigs. I took you there on
that's
our,
where we met on the morning of one of my favorite days of my entire life.
That was where we ended.
That's where we ended. Okay, great. Yes, life. You're right, correct.
Great pub. Good. Played there for the first time 15 years ago. First time I ever saw a dog on a string. You go there now.
You mean like a dog on a leash?
You know, a dog on a string held by a crusty punk.
Oh, of course. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
I didn't really know what I didn't see crusty punk. You know, this is where, you know, Big John from Conflict, you know, he runs the studio next door.
Amazing.
We can go to the pub there and go to a stop and chat, because there is a clientele there that even in today, you know, I'm sure the pub wouldn't want me saying this, but you know, if you go around there, people are hanging around sometimes.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's funny, this area. I live in Deptford, and it is small enough to know people. And that's the first place that I've lived in London that has that.
Sure. And I think that there's, you know, that stop and chat is a way that people have run their community for forever, you know?
Caveman stuff.
Yeah. Even the idea, we talked a little bit before we were recording about privacy and some of the changes to WhatsApp, just very briefly, and things like that. But I'd heard a viewpoint that privacy may be it's a temporary experiment to some extent, as we lived in groups of 50 to 100 people in tribal communities for most of the human's existence. You didn't have any, there's no privacy. You know, everyone needed to know your business, and
you're shitting in front of your neighbor.
Good. Yeah, you're shitting in front of your neighbor, you're fucking in front of your, you're dying in front of your neighbor, you know, like it's all together.
Sounds quite exciting.
Yeah, it does kind of sound exciting. But now you have the situations where you can be extremely private. Cool. I love that. Being private from the government, I think, is one thing.
Yeah.
But then knowing people in your neighborhood is extremely important. I remember I got closer to some of my neighbors when the social unrest, the rioting and protests happened in Philadelphia in the beginning of June. One of our neighbors, their business was the business next to it was being burnt down, and it's an animal hospital. So the neighbors organized a group to go rescue the animals, and it was like people watching each other's houses, and it turned into, you know, a way to meet everybody and then commiserate and talk and protect each other. When, you know, our cat, something as simple as our cat running away one day, the entire block came together to help us and let us know.
Great.
Like, called their friends. I was out searching with a flashlight, like, many blocks away, and somebody's like, oh, are you so-and-so? Are you looking for whatever? Like, yeah, my neighbor called me and said that the cat was missing and keep an eye out. And I was like, shit, this is a type of community I haven't experienced in a really long time. And that, I think that stop and chat kind of shit is something that comes up with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're Christian values, ultimately. And that's something I probably think a lot more now. I went to church when I was younger, and other than midnight mass, which was a family tradition, I probably haven't thought much about Christianity up until the last maybe year or so. And, you know, these are values that I really, you know, subscribe to, and I do see the value in it. And I think it actually makes the world it makes your world a better place. You know, I really see the value in being friends with my neighbor, even if I don't really like them, even if I don't really want to talk to them. I know that I can chat to them for 15 seconds and then bugger off.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, I think it's important to be nice to one another.
Yeah. I mean, you're more likely to trust them then too. You know, like I think that social trust is so important. Like, just a little bit of like, shit, I'm having an emergency. Can you help me in this very minuscule way? But, you know, I can trust you to do that. Or you want to help them, that kind of shit. Mm-hmm. But speaking of the Bird's Nest, I got to ask you, as an American, and most of the people listening to this, in the States, you know, as you know, you've been here many times, there's 50 states. Each state has its own metropolitan areas, all different governments that kind of react different ways. We didn't have a centralized authoritative response to the protocols that we launched after the coronavirus pandemic started.
Oh, neither did we.
Yeah, it's been a clusterfuck. But how in Deptford has it been managed? Like, how have you were there waves? Were you able to go to the pub? Do you still talk to people? Is it like, what's the vibe?
So some pubs were, and we, you know, we say pubs, you know, for the reason, for the fact that that's, you know, where you might go hang out.
That's the measure, yeah.
We don't really have coffee shops open until 9 p.m. like you do in the States, for example.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, coffee shops will shut at 4. So if you want to be social, it's going to be in a place where they're selling alcohol.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, and sorry for interrupting, but the pub, in my experience, is also more of a community center. We think of a bar, and I feel like you guys also have bars, which is a specific type of pub. That's like you go there to drink alcohol, get drunk, there'll be a show, whatever. And a pub can be something like that, or it can also be the place on the corner where you can go get dinner. You can have a birthday party and have the family there, like that kind of shit.
The lines are way more blurred here than there are in the States, I'd say.
Okay, cool.
You know, there are some pubs that do amazing food. There are some pubs that don't do amazing food, but they might sell exactly the same range of lagers or beers or wines or whatever.
Okay.
I mean, I would say, I reckon it's pub by pub. So the Bird's Nest, it's got such an amazing musical history. Like, you know, Kay Tempest is from this area.
Cool.
It's up to the pub's discretion as to how community-based it is, just by way of their actions. So Bird's Nest is community in the sense that you can put on events there for free. You know, whether that's a crust punk gig or a hip-hop night, or it's a refugee communication night, or if it's a food bank, that happens at the Bird's Nest. Because the people that run it are like, yeah, we'll do it. You know, it's as simple as that. There's an amazing place on Deptford High Street called Big John's Biltong Bar, where Big John makes his own biltong. His partner Zoe, they run the bar together. It's amazing, you know. And so
I like that
here. If you've got a place that's street facing, if you have the ability to make it a hatch front, i.e. you don't walk in, then people have made it happen here.
Extremely similar to us. That's basically the same thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Big John's Biltong Bar was amazing. My partner Eva, who you know, she made me an amazing scavenger hunt where, you know, she went to all these local shops and businesses and bar. You know, well, sorry, but well, Big John's Biltong Bar is probably more of a bar, I'd say.
Okay.
And you know, puts little clues here, there, and everywhere, and. You know, Dire Straits played their first ever gig just in the council estate behind here. So
cool.
She made all these little, you know, diagrams or maths equations, and I come rubbish with that. And all these things I had to work out, and she'd help me. And so we ended up at Big John's Biltong Bar, and you can get a pint of Pimm's, you know, a pint of Pimm's, pretty strong stuff. Yeah. You know, it was the height of summer, last year.
So a pint of Pimm's, not a Pimm's cup.
Yeah, I don't know what's a Pimm's cup.
Pimm's cup has like other ingredients into it.
So oh, sorry, it's Pimm's and lemonade.
Yeah, okay, that's basically what it is. Yeah.
And so, you know, that would be a fiver, and prices were coming down because of the fact they kind of knew they had to try and get people out and do all this stuff. You know, and I say that thing about the scavenger hunt because I can't really imagine living many other places where you could do that, where you could go to these local businesses and I mean, everyone has the ability, but it is cool to live somewhere where you're you can just make of it what you want. And I haven't mentioned Soho Radio here, actually. I started volunteering there as a producer in 2017.
So that's what I wanted to get into next, actually, was what you've got going on now. You're at Soho Radio, which sounds fucking cool as hell. I'm really so excited for you on that one, man.
So cool. Thank you so much. I mean, you know, it's the kind of place where you go in and you do as much as you want to do. If that's a, you know, everyone's a producer, which means that they do what I do on The Hangover Cure. Which is the show I talked about before,
which is on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. where you literally go in, crack a beer and cure your hangover.
And that's just been so amazing because I thought after years of touring in a band, I probably felt in my belly that I didn't have much to learn, which sounds really stupid, doesn't it? But started working at Soho Radio and realized there's so much joy in listening to jazz and neo soul and, you know, electronic music, stuff that I would never listen at parties that, you know, people I know were putting on, or, you know, like these whole new worlds, and actually meeting people that were older than me, but had the same, you know, had this excitement about music, about putting on a club night in a garage or a massive venue or everywhere in between, and being excited about that, you know, that stuff's really infectious.
Yeah.
And so that opened my eyes into like, oh no, you know, you still can just have a good idea or, you know, what you perceive as a good idea and, you know, chase it.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I'm sure anyone else working at the radio station has their own experiences, but, you know, they're all positive experiences. You know, I've never really met someone there who wasn't there because they didn't, you know, everyone likes music there. Everyone's yeah. just, everyone's there to enjoy it.
Yeah, if you need one tying commonality between each other, the fact that you love music and are working together at the radio station is a pretty damn good place to start. Like, that's a good
for real
top-down kind of what mission statement to have, you know?
Like, at first, when I first put on my I do a show called Modern Lovers every other Tuesday morning, really early in the morning, 8 o'clock. I have to wake up at, you know, I'm really bad at waking up in the morning, but I haven't missed yet. not at the time of recording anyway. And, you know, I had to be really careful because there's Simone Marie, who plays bass in Primal Scream. She has a show, and Pete Perfides has a show, and that's a lot of guitar music. And Andy Smith, who plays guitar in Paul Weller's band, he's got a show. But there's not that many guitar music punk shows. There's not many punk shows on the station. So on my first show, I think I played a Caves track, and the manager was like, "What's this Blink 182 shit?" And so I had to be kind of, ever since then, I've had to be pretty careful about, you know, the line of pop punk.
Yeah, they move the bar on you. They're like,
yeah, I love really that stuff. Funny. You know, Caves, to me, they're a garage punk band. But so, you know, I do, that is something that I, you know, I thought about when working there, because, like I said, their range is mostly, you know, up, and that's the thing, they're so open-minded. You know, they're so open-minded. I have so many great chats with people.
So you think working there has made you expand your musical horizons and what you kind of not only are listening to, but what you're sharing and with other people? Kind of like,
it made me feel more confident to have a good idea and, well, try and have an idea and pursue it. Whether that's something like making a little screen print for that thing that, you know, it's not, we're not talking lifetime shit. We're just talking little things that make you feel good.
The art and expression to the world for the reason of doing it, not necessarily to fit the end goal of like, oh, this fits in the paradigm of punk rock, or I'm going to make $20 on this, like that kind of shit.
And one vital ingredient, it's not meritocratic. Do you know what I mean? It's you're not, you're like, oh, you are now at XP level 11.
Meritocratic in the sense that you're striving for an upward movement or like, hell yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're there to just do your thing. And, you know, I make mistakes every day.
Yeah.
Every damn day. Sometimes I get bummed out more than others, you know, if I've like interrupted a broadcast with something I shouldn't have done, but you know, it happens.
Mic on.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you ordering
stuff like
lunch
that
or some shit? Yeah.
But I also think actually that's why it's exciting.
Yeah.
You know,
It's a little more high stakes, and you're finding the thing that is the same in all of the different parts. You know, you're finding the commonalities that are like, why are you attracted to this? Or why are you doing this instead of like, being on autopilot and being more
and saying you're human.
Yeah, exactly.
And just,
I personally, I have will always have an amazing nostalgic connection to Deptford. And I don't remember where our hotel was when Dave March and Roger Harvey and I stayed in this small hotel next to the Cutty Sark, which is that boat that's on the, Thames? Like it's an old, so there's a Scotch, like a blended Scotch whiskey in the States, Cutty Sark. And also Murakami features it prominently in a lot of his novels. So we were staying right by that boat, which I thought was really cool. But I met up with you on one of the greatest days of my life where I could have died after that day. It was Roger Harvey and I were each going to take a 90-day sobriety pact afterwards. So we're like, all right, well, we're going to go all out on this day. So I pulled up the list. We started it out at... this has been a mystery for me because it's been listed on this list and I've been meaning to ask you forever. The Old Something. Do you remember what the breakfast place we went to was? Was it the Royal Albert or was it the first place we went to?
So you had breakfast at the Greenhouse Cafe on New Cross Road.
Okay,
and then you went across the road to the Royal Albert indeed.
Yeah, so the first one wasn't called The Old Something. I probably just wrote that being a cynical bastard or cheeky bastard being like, it had to have been The Old Something. It's in England. What was it called?
The Royal Albert.
No, the one before that.
The Greenhouse Cafe is where you had breakfast.
Okay, cool. I need to put that one down because I'm making a t-shirt of the tour that we did that day. So it was the Greenhouse Cafe.
Yeah.
Then we went to the Royal Albert.
Yeah.
Then we went to the Shipwreck.
Yeah, right next to London Bridge Station.
Yep. And this is all of us traveling into like Camden or whatever. And then the shipwreck. We got that. Then the World's End.
Mm-hmm.
And then classic. Then we went to the Holly Arms.
Mm-hmm. Classic again. Amy Winehouse land.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's where we met up with Kevin Jones and them.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone who we ran into on the street, and anytime someone had recognized me on the street as being from the Menzingers, they were all on their way to see Jawbreaker.
Cool.
Yeah, I remember.
Was it that night? That's funny.
Yeah, maybe that was that night. Then we went to Dublin Castle.
Yep.
Then we went to Blackheart. Another classic one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we went to the Old Blue Last, which is where we played our first show in London. Then we went to, quote, another bar with Pimm's. That's just going to have to remain a mystery forever. And then we went to the Indian restaurant. And then we went to The Bridge, which is one of my favorite bars I've ever been to in my entire life.
James Hull took us there.
Yeah, he did. And then we got an offy wine from like the corner store. And then we ended it with a shot of Rumplemintz at the Bird's Nest. So we went through the gamut that day.
That was fun.
And then we took a break the next morning. It was not feeling good the next morning, but it was some of the most fun I've ever had.
That's great. I went to work the next morning. The hangover cure. Had the hangover cure.
I wish I'd listened to you at the hangover cure that morning.
It's great though. You know, all those pubs you said there in Camden, they're all big. You know, they've all got such massive histories. I mean, the World's End is above the Underworld, which is, you know, that's where, you know, every single touring band in the early 2000s.
Yeah, we played there with Muncie Girls a long time ago.
Great. Yeah. And it's amazing there, isn't it?
Yeah, it was super cool.
The backstage is painted all black.
Yeah, because it was painted all black.
Slash wanted it that way. No, seriously.
We got to start putting more, what would we call it, home improvement or structure. We need to put more structural changes into our rider, you know?
Green wall, man.
Yeah, you got a green wall. That's not the first place that we played where the back stage or the green room had some kind of facet to it that was from a rider. There's so many that were like, yeah, we had to build this bathroom because so-and-so played a secret show here. They didn't use it, and they didn't come in the green room, but we built the bathroom. You know, like that kind of shit.
Fucking assholes.
Right? It's so funny. They probably don't even know.
What's the most outlandish request the Menzingers have made?
We used to put, well, it's not really outlandish. We used to have cigarettes on the rider, like cartons of cigarettes.
They're expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just like, that was unheard of for whatever reason. But I don't, because they'll give you as much booze as you want. You know, it's not like an issue of kids getting it.
With booze, it's kind of annoying. You get too much booze sometimes, right?
Yes, that's correct.
You can't take it home if you're flying, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I feel like everybody, Dave March in Macclesfield has probably 11,000 half-drank bottles of liquor in his basement that we've left in various vehicles. But most outlandish requests we've made, man, you know, it's kind of some old man shit, but we're trying to not play venues that don't have working bathrooms in the backstage because of like just the complete chaos of logistics. That's some old man shit, not really outlandish. I don't know. Yeah. I'll think of an outlandish one.
Yeah, text me.
If I can think of it in the intro. But we've definitely had some like, I don't know. My favorite was somebody put Talking Parrot on their rider, Broadway Calls, and then a couple of venues would have one like drawn on the wall. You know, like someone would draw a parrot.
That's pretty cool.
Hello, Broadway Calls. I thought that was really funny. Cool.
Great.
So I wanted to wrap it up with you, man. Thank you so much for coming and talking to me. What have you got going on right now? What are you working on and what are you excited for? I mean, you've been this entire year doing the podcast world. It's a super fascinating place. It's growing a lot. And, you know, I'm really stoked about what you're doing. You've been really inspiring with the creep shit that you've done and with 101. Mm-hmm. You're right. It is more fun to say than 101. But what do you got coming up?
Right now I'm editing audiobooks for this AI company. Which, like, I think you might find interesting. So
that sounds fucking awesome.
You know, speech to text. So yes. you know, you talk to your phone and you say what you want to be in text, and that's pretty standard these days, right?
Sure.
Imagine that the opposite way around, where you write, you know, a text, a manuscript, and you have the technology to make that sound like someone saying it, you know, with the phonetics, with the right tone, with the right rhythm, with the right length, all that kind of stuff. So there's a company called Deep Zen that do that.
That's
not
an ominous name for something like that or anything.
I know. So I'm working as a freelance editor for them right now, which is great. So, you know, I'll get the manuscript through and I'll change, you know, you edit the emotion in the lines and the text, which is cool.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's mad because they have the patent of, you know, what it is.
Nice.
And it's good. It's good.
That's interesting. There's actually, so the program I'm going to use to edit this podcast episode that I've been using to edit podcasts and videos recently is called Descript. It's a company or a startup maybe based in San Francisco, go figure. And it also has a function, like a beta feature of that I haven't tried yet. So basically you read a script into the app, which is called Descript, and it's about 10 or 15 minutes long. And then after that, you'll be able to type to speech or text to speech or whatever the correct terminology is, parts of podcasts or an audiobook or whatever you're working on to fix things or change them. So like if I keep a log of my voice, you know, I say a lot. If I want to erase the ums or fix some shit like that, apparently I'll be able to type it in.
Smart.
Which is pretty crazy because you figure if a company like the one you're working for has that and this one that I subscribe to for like $20 a month has it, imagine what DARPA has and what that's going to do to like media and truth and reporting. And you think your aunt's Facebook group is rough now. Just wait until they have a call of, you know, Obama saying that he's locking kids up in tunnels and shit, you know.
That those fake video thing, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, deep fake videos, but just the speech to text one. Like imagine how easy it would be to scam somebody I hacked in your Alexa in your office that you're talking about how you have, and I have enough of you and Eva speaking that I was able to call one of you as the other one and get you to go to an ATM and give me money credit or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, if it's not at a festival, I'm not interested. Don't worry about anyone. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, you need to keep your eye on festival organizers. You need to keep your eye on Giles.
Bad boy. Other than that, though, I am coming up to the 101st episode.
Wait, what are you going to do?
Write a book.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So I'm looking at it right now on InDesign. I learned InDesign at university.
Very cool. That's an Adobe Suite app, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And Eva's doing these illustrations. She did one of Kevin Morby, which is absolutely amazing. And going to get it printed. We're doing some research on books. Print it, you know, getting books printed.
Sure.
Because I know that I'm going to order something and it's just going to be kind of shit. So I'm just trying to be really careful about that. And I'm asking for samples, you know.
Great.
Trying to be smart about it. And so that's what I'm working on right now. Yeah. And, you know, with Eva, and that's cool to collaborate together because, you know, working with your partner is fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's great. It's amazing. It's so cool. My fiance Beth Ann is also a writer and was a music journalist. That's how we met. She's working on her master's in writing now and just talks about the publishing industry a lot. Actually, she just learned a bunch about it. It's really interesting. But yeah, man, I am so excited that you are putting a book out. I can't wait to have it on my shelf.
Hell yeah! I mean, I've just written like the one on. let me look at it. Thurston Moore, due to being one of the most definitive rock bands in the world of Sonic Youth, Thurston Moore hasn't had many part-time jobs in recent memory, but he did have these things to say. So I want to make it funny. Funny. That's something I internally struggle with, I think, a little bit. I want to be, you know, I like having a laugh. I like making other people laugh. I like making myself laugh. But tying that in with something that's kind of a career thing, you know, I don't know. I'm in the process, you know, I'm in a process.
Oh yeah, I love it. There's that old adage of like musicians wanting, like thinking that they're funny and comedian. I think it was Dave Chappelle or somebody talked about it. Musicians all think that they're funny and comedians all want to be musicians. That struggle for humor is such an interesting ride. There's sometimes I know that like Greg does it and I do it as well. We're songwriters, but you try to write jokes and then you write it down and then you like text it to everybody or you say it and it's just not funny at all.
It's so funny. You can be an absolute wordsmith with like an amazing song. You know what I mean? You can really capture a real tiny moment.
Yeah.
You try and write a joke, but yeah, I think I think you're funny.
Yeah, well, ditto. And I think writing a joke is sometimes harder because to be able to have a wider appeal for humor is not as easy. Besides, you know, puns and dad jokes, which are the best.
The written joke is hard.
Yeah.
Because on WhatsApp, you know, I do think the funniest things I'll say on WhatsApp are like the shortest things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think you've got to keep it snappy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You can't be, you know, rolling into a joke that would take a setup and a knockdown. You can't have acts in your jokes. There's no one, two, and three. You got to be able to deliver at once.
Yeah. It's a dangerous game, you know, trying to be funny on WhatsApp because that's where I see myself. In any group WhatsApp chat, my role there is to take the piss and be funny. but then you try and say something serious and no one gets you.
No one gets it. Write it off. I love that. But yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on. I can't wait. I'm going to throw up some links in show description that'll show up for your shit. And I really appreciate it. I can't wait if I'll have you back again. I would love that so much.
Please do. Please do. And hey, I got to say,
I got you on record. That's great.
I'm loving the Menzingers Patreon.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much.
The Discord, because a lot of people are doing Patreon, and then when it's a band you really feel connected to and you love, I got so much satisfaction from signing up to it.
And
thank you for doing it. And it's you can't do that half-heartedly. So props to you not doing it half-heartedly.
Thanks, man. That was part of the reason why we didn't do it. We've been kicking around for a while and it wasn't really that tested, but we really wanted to make sure that we didn't look at any of it as something that we didn't want to do. We wanted to be as passionate as we could for all the stuff. So it's been a lot of fun. And I've already learned a bunch of shit from just chatting with people in Discord. So it's been fucking fun.
I was going to say the Discord server, like that's my new, when we were younger, we used to use a forum called punktastic.com, which is where I've met half the people I know in London about music. Discord's my new Punktastic forum now.
Hell yeah, man. I'm subscribed to a couple ones that I do with Patreon for and a couple other ones. And it's a great way to socially interact with people and learn things. It's cool.
It's great. You can I love posting pictures about food and shit. It's fun.
Yeah, dude, it's a blast. But all right, man. Awesome. Well, I'll talk to you soon. Love
you,
bro.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Hell yeah. And there we have it, my friends. Huge thanks to Giles for coming onto the show. You can check out 101 Part-Time Jobs on any of the major podcast platforms. Whatever you use, I'm sure you can find it. You can also check out Modern Lovers on Soho Radio. He also helps produce The Hangover Show, which we got to talk about a bit, which I'm so excited to check out one of these days. Except it'll be in the middle of the night for me. Whatever. We'll listen to a recording. Thank you so much, Giles, and I cannot wait to see what you have in store for the future. Once again, the intro song is by Queen Jesus. You can check out Queen Jesus online. That is Pat Breyer's project. So honored that I get to use this song every time we do this. This was produced by Beth Ann Downey. If you want to get at me, please send me an email, tom@futurefriday.net. I would love to hear from you. And until then, so long.